Welcome to Stage 16, another episode, our second with Stuart Bannerman. Thank you for teaming up with me on this again and in the future. In advance, I thank you. Sorry we did not get an episode out in March, guys, but some personal stuff going on that caused us to delay just a little bit. But we're back now for the 15 of you who are listening, and we're going to get right into it. So
I think it's gone up since, like, if it's 15 now, then we're doing better because it's an incline. I'm sure you gave us a smaller number last time.
I might have only had like 12 last time.
Yeah, we have gone up.
Three people. Yeah. So let's start with what we kind of talked about wanting to do, which is, you know, we lost, now we've lost two great actors, unfortunately, great character actors, but we had talked about discussing the career of Mr. Tom Sizemore. And so we sort of, you know, we have a top five picked out. I know mine, for example. I don't think I'm going to surprise anybody or blow anyone's mind with a performance they probably haven't seen, but obviously he's a stellar actor, so we'll talk about that. And then just personally, I did want to say, because he was a guest on my other podcast last season on character, Lance Reddick passed away shockingly at 60 years old. I didn't know him personally other than the time that I spent with him on the other podcast, which in reality was probably close to, you know, 2 hours, but we cut it down to an hour. So actually my co-host and partner and producer on that show is trying to see if there's any material that we could release, because he was just a fantastic guy. He was so lovely and friendly and really generous with his time. So
all of it, Sean. All of it, release all of it. Having not heard the 2 hours that Lance was talking with you, I've heard the cut down version that everybody got to hear. I would say release it all.
Just put up the raw, yeah. Everything.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was just so nice. And I don't know. I mean, that guy, look, I'm out of shape. I mean, that guy doesn't look like he was ever out of shape, ever. So it was really shocking to hear that. So yeah, rest in peace, Lance Reddick and Tom Sizemore, who we're going to talk about now.
Before we move off Lance Reddick, what's the first Lance Reddick or the one Lance Reddick project that springs to, other than your character conversation with him, of course, but what was the first thing you recall seeing him in?
The Wire, probably. I think it was The Wire.
I think it was Oz for me.
Okay.
Really?
Oz. Yeah, because at that time I was kind of like, I don't know, a prison show. Do I really want to watch this? So I still to this day have not seen Oz.
It's amazing. The amount of, we sort of play this game now called Oz Watch, because when you watch Oz, you watch it now, you recognize like 90% of the cast. But at the time when Oz came out, there was, we hadn't seen Lance Reddick before, Louis Guzman. Wasn't too familiar with it, although I'd seen him in a few small parts, but they're all in it. And Oz is amazing. If anybody asks me to name my favorite shows of all time, you've got Band of Brothers in there. You've got Oz is definitely in there as well. And that was the first thing that I ever saw Lance in.
Band of Brothers is one of my all-time favorites too, but I don't count it as a series for whatever reason. I count it as, like, you know, as a one-off thing.
Yeah.
And The Pacific, I didn't love as much. So I don't even count those as like connected tissue. You know what I mean? And now there's a third one coming.
There is. I haven't seen The Pacific yet. I've had it on DVD on my shelf since it came out, just for some reason. Well, not for some reason. Not enough time in the day. I have not got around to watching The Pacific yet.
I don't know. It just didn't. It didn't capture that. I guess maybe it was down to the characters, right? Because the characters in Band of Brothers are what sucked me in. Obviously, I like war films or certain war films, but Band of Brothers was something entirely different. All of those actors, all those guys were so good, especially, you know, Damian Lewis's Winters. It was incredible. And then, so now they have Masters of the Air coming out, which is about the pilots and the bombers. That's pretty cool. I'm into that. So let's talk about Mr. Sizemore. Tell me this. What was the first thing you remember seeing him in?
Do you know what? I'm looking at his IMDb, and the first thing I ever saw him in was his feature film debut, which was Lock Up, because I was a big Stallone fan, certainly in the 80s. And so anything that Stallone brought out, I would rush off to cinema to watch if I could, or watch on VHS if I wasn't able to. And I went to cinema to see Lock Up. So that would be the first thing I saw him in.
Okay. Now, what year was Lock Up?
That was 1989. Same year he was in Born on the 4th of July, which is a film I've seen many, many times.
And what's funny, see, I've seen Born on the Fourth many, many times too. In fact, when I was a young whippersnapper running around the beach in Venice, California, the real Ron Kovic used to live in a tiny little, I mean, I feel like it was almost a one room bungalow, but it was right on the strand, right off of like Washington Boulevard, where Washington Boulevard dead ends at the beach. And he lived there. And I used to play on that beach. And my mom used to sing at a bar called the Sunset Bar and Grill on Washington Boulevard. And I was what they called a latchkey kid. I don't know if they called you guys.
Yeah.
But I was, you know, left to my own devices often. So I would just walk down to the strand, and it's a wonder I never got kidnapped. But I used to hang out with the real Ron Kovic. So I knew about that film by the time it was made, and I've seen it quite a few times. And yet I don't really remember Sizemore in the movie.
It's only a really small, you would probably call it a cameo, probably 2 minutes if that. And I think it is when Ron Kovic runs off to Mexico and starts drinking himself into a stupor and hanging around with prostitutes and stuff like that. I think Sizemore is one of those people in the bar, but it's only a very small role.
That would make sense for him to be in that kind of a role at that time.
Because he's been in, like, you know, a couple of Oliver Stone films, so they obviously became buddies or whatever. So
right. Yeah, I mean, he certainly, over the course of his career, he had some of the greatest filmmakers alive wanting to work with him. And he was able to work with most of them, I want to say.
And you look at his filmography, he's worked with Catherine Bigelow, Oliver Stone, Michael Mann, Tony Scott. So obvious. Tony Scott a couple of times, to be honest. Brian De Palma, Michael Bay, Ridley Scott. So yeah, he has been with the greats.
So I worked with him twice. Not that I'm a great. I'm just throwing it out there as a non sequitur comment. But I did a TV movie called Witness Protection with him. He was not, as you might imagine, given his public life, the easiest guy to work with. And then that was years after I had first met him. And when I first met him was on the first big movie that I ever worked on, which was called Strange Days.
Love that movie. Love this
and
movie.
That was Catherine Bigelow. But I didn't know him from Born on the Fourth. And then I saw another Catherine Bigelow movie called Blue Steel with Jamie, now Academy Award winner, Jamie Lee Curtis. And he has a small part in that as a stick-up guy in a supermarket, and he murders a couple people in front of her, and the police are forced to shoot him in very dramatic fashion. But even in that moment, as another example, he comes in to rob this store, and he's so intense and so kind of terrifying that I was like, who's that guy? He's going to be somebody to watch. And certainly he turned out to be. And so Blue Steel was only the next year after Born on the Fourth, 1990. And it's, again, Jamie Lee Curtis and Ron Silver. And it's a pretty, and Clancy Brown's in it as well. Really good film if you've not seen it.
You're right about, I like the fact you touched upon the fact that he's, no matter what size role he does, he's always very intense. And I remember seeing him, and I always used to get really excited about seeing Tom Sizemore on the credits, and I would watch it because I always knew that whether it was a co-starring role or a starring role or a little bit part, he was always going to be interesting to watch.
Yeah, somebody asked, I think on Twitter, somebody was saying, like, what's your, right after he passed, what's your best, you know, your most memorable Tom Sizemore lines or something like that? And I actually replied with his Agent Dietz from Point Break, which is an uncredited role for him. But I love it. I love what he looks like. I love what he says. I think it's like five moments of genius.
Isn't it something about, like, look at my hair. Do you know how long it's taking? I can't wash this off. Or he goes mad about his appearance, doesn't he?
He goes, you think I like these clothes, man? You think I like this hair? He's like, my wife wants me to stay at Ramada. And I think Pappas goes, like, oh, that's a nice tattoo there, Dietz. And he goes, oh, yeah, you like that? Fuck you, Pappas. And I'm almost certain that that last little bit was an improv between the two of them, you know?
Yeah, it just, I would think
so. Felt so real and natural, you know? Like, it's great.
You look at his filmography, though, and it's just the amount of my favorite films in his list are just, you know, they're not necessarily favorite in my list because they're Tom Sizemore films, but they're great films that he happens to be in and obviously helps make them great. But you look at 1994, it's got three of my favorite films in there. You've got Strange Days, which is 95 technically, Natural Born Killers and Wyatt Earp in a row. And I love those three films. So, you know, they may be in my top five, but
it's interesting. And Wyatt Earp never really registered for me. It followed, if I'm not mistaken, it followed Tombstone.
Yeah.
And for me, Tombstone was the better movie just in terms of, you know, action. And I felt like Kilmer was a better doc than Dennis Quaid for me. And just the way that I could appreciate what Kasdan did and what Costner were doing, but as a younger person at that point, it didn't register the way that Tombstone did.
I think for me, Tombstone is more fun. It's more of an entertaining popcorn fun film. And the reason I love Wyatt Earp more is that it feels more like an epic classic cinema. You know, everybody looks dirty and messed up and stuff in it. And the bullets look like they hurt. Whereas in Tombstone, which I've not seen for a few years, but it just looks like more put your feet up, have a laugh. You know, let's watch Val Kilmer chewing the scenery up. Very well, he does it as well. And all the big mustaches and all that sort of stuff. So,
speaking of Val, so Sizemore and Val did a movie together, which I didn't think was a very good movie. And it was kind of a flop. It was called Red Planet. And just having worked for Val on a movie and then having done two things with Sizemore, I really can't imagine through on Red Planet and what they must have gone through. I can share one story. It's a little bit out of school, and I won't tell what project it was on, but this is a direct experience that was relayed to me about Sizemore. So Sizemore did a movie. I have to look it up. I don't know what year it was. Play It to the Bone is a boxing movie, and a lot of it was done in Las Vegas, and a friend of mine was sent out to the set and to run base camp, which is, you know, where all the trailers are and the hair and makeup and wardrobe and everything. And my friend says to me, so one day, you know, the call time comes around and it's basically the whole day is about Tom. Like they call it shooting them out, like trying to get them finished with the movie so we can go on to his next thing. And he hadn't shown up, and they were like, well, I mean, we literally can't shoot. There's nothing we can shoot without him. He's the whole day. Like, we can try and call in other people, but like, what's going on? So what they did was they put this person, my friend, in a van, and they said, we're going to send you to his house and you just try and wake him up, knock on the door and wake him up. And so I will say that this is a female, because that makes the story even a little more surprising. She gets in the van and she goes to the house that they had leased for him or whatever outside the city, and she's knocking on the door and nobody's answering, and she kind of tries to see if she'd go around the side of the house and nobody's answering. Can't get to the back of the house because she's gonna have to scale a fence. And so she comes back to the van and she's like, I have to call them because I don't know what to do. And the driver's like, well, just try and knock one more time and then we'll just go back. I mean, whatever, you know, we can't just sit here. So she goes to the door again and she knocks and there's no answer again. And as she's walking back to the van, she hears the door open. She hears this and she turns around and he's standing at his front door in a robe with a shotgun.
That's not good.
Like, me from the production, I'm just, you missed your call time and they told me to come get you. And he's like, okay. Yeah. You can come inside. Come on in. I'll get ready. She's like, no, it's cool. I'll wait in the van. Like, are you kidding me? You pull a shotgun? So yeah, that's the type of personality that people were dealing with. I think most people by now know the story from Heat, which, are you familiar with what De Niro did? With
I am not, no. So I am not yet included in the most people crowd. Okay.
I think it's been written before. I'm not positive, but essentially at that point he had had problems with heroin. It was starting to affect the production, and it was like he was managing it, but he wasn't quite hiding it. If that makes sense, I guess at the end of the shoot or on his last day. De Niro showed up at his place where he was staying with his mother, with Tom Sizemore's mother. And De Niro sat him down and said, this is not a discussion. You're getting on a plane. I've chartered a private plane for you. You're getting on a plane and you're flying to Arizona and you're going into a rehab facility. And from what I understand, you know, Sizemore broke down. He was, I think at that point, I also think he said publicly, he was like, for whatever reason, people can shoot heroin in between their toes and stuff like that to mask it. But he was, I think he, you know, ruined his feet or something by that point. So he started shooting in his arm, and then he would take scalding hot like water from a kettle and pour it over his the crook of his arm to try and cover track marks and stuff like that. So, I mean, he was in a really bad way. And so De Niro sent him off to a rehab facility. And I guess, you know, at least for a time, it did work. But of course, you know, by the end, he sort of, when he was doing his TV series for Michael Mann called Robbery Homicide, he was kind of going off the rails again. And then he got into sort of, you know, domestic violence situation with his former madam girlfriend, Heidi Fleiss. So the man lived a life, that's for sure. There may be people listening to us now that are like, fuck that guy, you know. But me personally, I'm able to separate. I've been in the business long enough. I've almost had to learn to separate the art from the artist. And so to me, his the way he is on screen versus whatever he was in life. And that was somebody that was clearly troubled and dealing with a lot of issues. He's just a magnetic presence on screen, and probably some of his extracurricular activities or behaviors informed care. I mean, if you think about like Scagnetti in Natural Born Killers, I mean, that's very clearly, I think he and Oliver Stone were both probably doing a lot of mushrooms and stuff. Like there's no other explanation for the fever dream that movie is. You know, and the washed green color and all that kind of stuff. So, but anyway, so let's talk just a little bit about maybe your top five performances of his.
Considering he's got so many performances that could easily fill a top 15 to top 20, it was, but the top five for me just did leap out. In no specific order, I have his role in Black Hawk Down.
Yes.
How he managed to just stand and rattle off dialogue while big explosions were going off. Even that's impressive to watch. But his character was as tough as nails in that film. Nothing fazed him. He carried on saying what he needed to say while bullets were flying and things were going off all around him. And he was
at one point he gets
so
shot
intense.
In the neck or
he does. And he just carries on or whatever.
He goes, God damn it. And when you just keep going and you're like, God, these guys, you know,
crazy. But that's definitely, I think that probably would be my first one, I think, if I had to choose one. But number two, Saving Private Ryan, which he was also fantastic in. Number three, the aforementioned Strange Days, which is a film that I've just seen so many times over the years. Wyatt Earp, and finally Natural Born Killers as Jack Scagnetti. I did hear a story, and it's a very good book about the making of Natural Born Killers, written by one of the producers, Jane Hampshire. And so if you want any Natural Born Killers stories, just get that book. It's absolutely amazing. And I'm sure I read a story where when he slams against the door or when the fight scene's going on between him and Juliette Lewis, she actually knocked him out. So, you know, which doesn't surprise me. But yeah.
Wow.
What about yourself, Sean? What would you go for out of his huge list of films?
Well, yeah, we're going to have some matches there. But I actually go True Romance. That's one of the different ones I'll have. But Natural Born Killer Scagnetti is, I mean, I don't think I've ever seen a character like that. Heat and Private Ryan. And then probably McKnight in Black Hawk Down. Yeah.
Heat, very nearly. If it was the top six, then Heat would have been my number six.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I had to put Heat. I mean, just that moment in Heat when they take Wayne Grow back and they sit in that coffee shop and De Niro smacks Wayne Grow's head into the table, right? When they're because he killed the armored truck guards and all that, and like, he's the whole line is like, let's go out to the car and split up our take because I want to get rid of this motherfucker right here or whatever. Yeah. And you know, so they get up but the moment where De Niro smacks Wayne Grow's head in the table, there's a cutaway to a guy in a booth behind De Niro and Wayne Grow, who like looks up from his newspaper or something like that. And there's just this second where Sizemore like leans out to make eye contact with the guy. And his face is stone. He's like terrifying. And it's like a second of a cutaway. He leans out, he looks, and then they cut back to the guy in the other booth who immediately like puts his head back down and goes back to his newspaper. De Niro's just cracked a guy's face on a table and the glass, you know, shakes and the table shakes and like the silverware. And, you know, it's just so fantastic. He's so great. And then, of course, you know, the quote that most people use for him is the action is the juice. That's the one that people remembered the most, which, of course, is Michael Mann in Heat as well. But so that's why he had to be in there for me.
But it's such, he has done so many just amazing roles in great films over the year. He's definitely, I always, you know, here in the UK, whatever, usually when someone passes away, it's usually when I wake up in the morning and check my emails, and it's happened.
Yeah.
You know, so it's like, oh no. And I read that he'd collapsed and he was in hospital. And then it was, you know, they're looking at the end of life. Do they do what they do? And I'm like, no, don't. If anybody can get out of this, it's Tom Sizemore. Come on.
Yeah, this
Black Hawk down it. Be McKnight. And unfortunately, he wasn't. So it's definitely missed.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he leaves quite a legacy. Obviously, his last decade or so has not really been top of the line, not very wonderful. But the amount of films, probably, I guess, I don't know, all the way up to probably Black Hawk Down, and a couple after, but mostly up to that point. There are no actors like him that I can think of. Like, there's nobody in that range anymore. And to be honest, a lot of, you mentioned Tony Scott. I mean, obviously Ridley's what, 85 now. I know he's doing another Gladiator, but my friend and I were talking about it the other day. When Ridley goes, there are no other filmmakers doing what he does. And if you think about Tony Scott, there haven't been any films that equal Tony Scott. I mean, Maverick aside, where at least the first half of the movie is trying to do a sort of Tony Scott thing, although instead of like a red sky, they went with like yellow. But even that, I mean, they're paying homage, but they're not, nobody's doing what he did in Deja Vu or what he did in Enemy of the State, just his editing.
Domino. There's no Domino that I can think of.
Yeah, there's nobody that can do what these guys are doing. So we are rapidly approaching, you know, Tony's been gone for a long time now. Ridley, hopefully we have for another decade, but he's 85. So like, how many more films does he have in him? I don't know. But when these guys go, it's sort of like each one of them is like the end of an era.
It is. It's our childhood favorite filmmakers just departing to the big Hollywood sign in the sky.
Yeah. And these actors too. I mean, you don't expect a Lance Reddick to go at 60. No. And he certainly didn't look 60. He could have played easily, you know, the next 10 John Wick movies. Sizemore looked older than he was, I think, because of all the drugs and the alcohol and sort of the life that he led. But yeah, and when he was in top form, he was extraordinary. There just isn't anybody that equals that on-screen energy, at least for me.
I think if we were to go back maybe 10, 15 years, I would maybe put Ed Harris in that list where it's like, oh, Ed Harris is in this. He's going to go crazy and, you know, throw things around. But
yeah, I mean,
recently have I seen Ed Harris in anything.
There's a physical thing, right? Ed Harris is actually, I mean, like in The Rock, for example, he's a tough guy, but he's also very little. And for whatever reason, Sizemore came across as like barrel-chested, broad-shouldered, you know, a little heavier set, but like a sort of person that you would not want to tussle with, you know, like Ed Harris's intensity. There's no match for that, but he's a little guy. So you feel like you could, you know, if you got in a tussle, you might just be able to take him. You might.
Yeah.
But Sizemore, like, I don't think I would have ever had a chance in a second, you know, I mean, and not only size, but unpredictability. You know, like every character he ever played was borderline sociopath or psychopath. You know, like
I think it's like you said with reference to the scene from Heat. It's like if Ed Harris put his head around the corner and looked at you, you'd go, "What?" And then, and unless Ed Harris started shouting at you, then you'd sort of put your head back in. But if Tom Sizemore just looks at you, you're like, "Okay, sorry." I'll just go back to reading my paper.
Those crystal blue eyes that, like, if you really bored them into your skull, you'd be like, all right, man, all right, I'll go. I'll leave. But I wouldn't necessarily be intimidated by him physically in the beginning. But Sizemore, the physical intimidation would happen instantaneously. And then the you know, 1,000-yard blank stare would be like, this guy will destroy me.
I can't imagine anything scarier than knocking on somebody's door and it's Tom Sizemore in a bad mood with a shotgun. I don't even think he needs the shotgun person. It's just like stand there and stare at me in a bad mood. I'm off. Like,
what the fuck are you doing in my door? You know, you'd be like, sorry, sir. Sorry. I just have trick-or-treaters here.
Children and everything. Please stop scaring them.
So, all right. Well, that's our Sizemore list. I wanted to go back a second because I just noted, obviously, there is going to be a Gladiator 2. I think we touched on it in our first episode together. But since then, they have added Denzel Washington to the cast.
They have. I still don't know how I feel about a Gladiator 2, to be honest. I'm like, we don't need it. But you know what? We don't need a lot of films. Did we need a Top Gun 2? Not really. Did no. I enjoy it? Oh, yes, I did. It was my How favorite film of last year. So, yeah. You know, who knows?
I mean, I don't know. For some reason, there's part of me that's very conflicted because the actor who played Lucius in the first movie, in the original movie, is still an actor. His last movie was the M. Night Shyamalan thing that was the sequel to Unbreakable/Split. He's not a bad actor. He's a really good looking kid, guy, whatever. I don't know. He's like 20 something now, 25, 20, 30. Spencer Treat Clark is his name. And when he was in the sequel to Unbreakable, I was like, I didn't like that movie, by the way, but I thought he was good. And I was like, hey, how cool that they actually brought him back. But he was a good child actor in Unbreakable. He was a good child actor in Gladiator. So to recast him now, I mean, I know he's not a name. Nobody knows who Spencer Treat Clark is, but I would argue that even post-Oscar nomination, most of the people don't know who Paul Mescal is either.
And if you're releasing a film, you know, Ridley Scott directing Gladiator 2.
He's the star.
That's the name. That's the name you need, Gladiator 2. You could put a bunch of unknowns in that. You know, obviously, it depends on the director. Yeah. So you couldn't let just anybody direct it sort of thing.
Yeah, well, I mean, at this point, I don't know what they're going to call it. I don't know if they call it Gladiator 2 or they call it a Gladiator story, whatever they're gonna call it now, what they're doing these days. I'm sure it'll be a subtitle thing. But that movie, it's a Best Picture winner. It's held in, I think it's still held in relatively high esteem by people. I was talking with former co-host Sean Roberts, and he said for whatever reason he doesn't rewatch it often. But I was like, oh really? I do. I watch it at least once a year, probably. I think John Matheson's photography on the film is stunning. I think Russell Crowe, who won Best Actor for it, is incredible. Jaimin Hunsu, like, I just think it's excellent across the board. So do we need one? No. Am I down for a sequel? Yes. I just, some part of me feels bad for Spencer Treat Clark, and I'll probably get over it. I'll watch Paul Mescal and I'll think like, God, this guy's great. But I think it's interesting too that Ridley is going to reunite with Denzel. It's the first thing they've come back together for since American Gangster. By the way, is that called American Gangster?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I don't know if they change that one to like Brooklyn Gangster. Obviously we don't know who Denzel is playing. We do know that Paul Mescal is playing a grown-up version of Lucius, and supposedly Connie Nielsen, who played his mother in the first one, is coming back. So yeah, I'm very curious to see how they're doing that, because I guess Lucius would be, or maybe he became already at the end of the movie, right? Didn't he become emperor at the end?
I think he would have done. Yeah, I think he did. Yeah.
Is he just having gladiator games? I mean, does he turn into a bad guy? That would be weird. So yeah, I'm very curious about that. And adding Denzel to me is probably one of the more exciting casting choices I've heard recently.
Yeah, because you sort of think to watching a Denzel film that was terrible. Nothing springs to mind at the moment. I'm sure there might be one in his filmography somewhere, but if it is, it's many, 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 many years ago. He seems to choose his projects quite smartly.
Yeah,
as you would hope.
I mean, that Two Brothers, that Wahlberg thing wasn't very good.
I didn't like that.
Thing, like, he's always good, even if the movie's not. So, you know, or even if the movie's just so-so, right? Like, and he's got Equalizer 3 coming. I didn't think the second one was great. Did you?
I preferred number 2 to the first one. Really? I think for me, I really like the score of the second one more than the score of the first one. So that, you know, you put a good soundtrack on a reasonable film, it kind of elevates for me.
Yeah, I just like the whole hurricane thing at the end. And I think that was Pedro Pascal on that one, too. For whatever reason, I just didn't really like it. I was very much invested in the character in the first one of him and the little girl. And, you know, that sort of led him to the prostitution ring that he took down. And I like the villain in that movie, an actor named Martin Chokosh, who a lot of people don't know. He was in a movie called The Debt. He was in the Bourne Supremacy, the second one. He played a German sleeper agent that Bourne confronts like in his house and uses a wadded up magazine to like start beating him. He's a really good actor, but I thought the sort of Russian mafia aspect of the first one was really cool. And the second one just didn't register for me at all. I couldn't even tell you who the bad guys are. I guess his own teammates are the bad guys.
Yeah, like they were. Yep.
American government. Yeah. So, and then the ending of like the hurricane thing, I was like, boy, this is not, this is going on too long. It's not great. So, but having said that, I am looking forward to the next one. And even his last movie, which I think was The Thing with Jared Leto, if I'm not mistaken, The Little Things.
Yeah, I haven't seen that one yet. Because I was on holiday and that was on, and I saw, I think, a couple of scenes from the third act. So I'm like, oh. So I'll watch that at some point. I've just never got around to watching it.
Yeah, I begrudgingly thought that Jared Leto was the best thing about it. He's so weird and the prosthetics are quite excellent. And I'm not normally a fan of his. I feel like some of his off-screen persona seeps into what I think of him on screen and I just can't get on board.
Yeah.
Or at least recently, like, you know, back in the Fight Club days, it was like, this kid's really good. Requiem for a Dream, stuff like that. But recently his sort of persona has overshadowed any acting he's done for me.
Is it testing your separating art from the artist role? Like, it's not broken yet, but
it is.
Stop
it
bending
is.
It, Jared. Stop bending it.
Like I watched, well, it's not that, because like, again, I watched The Little Things and I was like, he's the best thing in it. Like, he's really, really good in it. And he's really weird and he's got this weird walk and they put like a sort of fat suit belly on him. He's got contacts and he just looks so strange. And he's excellent, but I don't want to like him. You know, like part of me is like, God, I hate even saying it. I don't want to, like, you know, not that he cares what I think, but like, I don't want to fill the guy's head any more than it seems to be. But anyway, so I mean, is it worth watching? Yeah, it's worth watching. I think it's worth watching for him. I'll tell you what I don't like about Denzel. For me, Denzel has a lot of personal tics, not unlike somebody like Brad Pitt, for example, personal tics that make their way into every role at one point or another. You know, the real sort of, you'll be able to see me doing it, but the audience won't. But he's got this thing of like, when he checks his watch, if he's got a long sleeve thing on, he like throws his arm out to like pull the sleeve back, you know, like he just throws his arm out and then does that. Looks at the watch. So there's that. He likes to do this thing where he pulls, you know, he gets angry and he says something like, they tried my wife. And he like slams his wrists against his chest. Some of that feels like it's stuck around ever since he won the Oscar for Training Day.
Yeah.
Because Training Day was, you know, he's very big in that movie. Not such that he is bigger than the movie, but he's very big and very showy in the film. And so there are a few people, like if you look at Pacino post Scent of a Woman, post Oscar win, he screamed and yelled a lot in that movie and then won an Oscar. And it seems like he sort of went, oh, I just have to scream and yell now. That's what people want to see. So he just screams and yells and everything.
It's like Richard Gere, he does that look down and then that sigh.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the Richard Gere's got one as well. So
yeah. And Pitts is like a hand thing too. He just does this like wrist thing that he does. So it's such a sort of like, you know, I don't know. Like I think of it sometimes, if I was a director, would I go up to Denzel and be like, hey Denzel, you did that in like your last five movies, can you not do that? No, probably not. I just shut my fucking mouth and let Denzel does. But he does have these little tics that make it in, and sometimes they bother me. So that's it. But I'm still a huge fan.
You could turn it into like some sort of drinking game, couldn't you? I'm about to watch a new Denzel movie, so every time he does the watch thing, I take a drink and just see if you can make it to the end credits.
The other thing is, I'm curious. I obviously, you know, we don't know who he's going to play in Gladiator 2 or Gladiator, you know, the later years, whatever they call it. But I'm curious if he's going to do any fighting. If he's going, I mean, he does fighting in the Equalizer movies, obviously, but for the last, I want to say 10 years, another thing that's bothered me about Denzel is that it almost looks to me like Denzel says to the people, I don't need a costume designer. I'm just going to wear my own clothes and what I show up in is what we're going to shoot. And they kind of go, okay, Denzel, whatever you say. Because I think he has put on a little weight over the years. And if you look at, even back to that Wahlberg movie, Two Guns or whatever it was called, he wears these super bulky shirts, button down shirts, short sleeve generally. And they're really big there. You can't, you know, there's no physicality underneath them. I thought it was quite funny in Little Things because he plays, if I'm remembering correctly, at least at the start, like a small town sheriff. So he's in a sheriff's uniform, but the shirt is tucked into the pants and then pulled out to the point that it's just, you know, like you're like, is he heavy set? Is he, what is he? So I just find it funny that like every movie he's in now is like, he just wears these long shirts untucked, like out, and has the a very similar look. If you go, just look at that, even do that as like a drinking game, like put on four movies in a row and then look at what he's wearing in every scene. And I swear to God, he's wearing these triple XL shirts. So you can't see that he's put on any weight at all.
I will. Will I watch? Will you watch Gladiator 2? Yes, I'll watch it. But they've been saying that they're going to make it for years, though. But I think this is the furthest they've ever got by announcing casting and stuff.
Yeah, so. I mean, at this point, it's happening. And I guess over in your neck of the woods, probably, or at least partially, and then over in Malta.
I think Ridley seems to like Malta and Morocco a lot, doesn't he? Seems to shoot a lot of stuff there. So we shall see. Yeah. So you haven't seen John Wick 4 yet, have you?
No, have you?
I have.
Oh.
I'm not going to spoil it at all. I don't like spoiling films, but I loved it. It's just, yeah. I look at how old Keanu is, and I'm younger than him. And it embarrasses me watching that. I'm like, I'm tired watching this film, Keanu. How on earth do you manage to do half of this stuff? You take 30 seconds out of John Wick 4, which is just short of 3 hours. It doesn't seem like 3 hours, so it flies by. There is a post-credit scene as well, so stick around after the credits.
Okay.
And even a 30-second scene is more exercise than I do in probably a month. So I'm quite embarrassed to be a human being, so thanks, Keanu and Chad. Yeah. Much appreciated.
Yeah, well, I've just started to get back on my treadmill, but yes, he makes us all look bad. He's also an incredibly lovely human being, which also makes most of the rest of us look bad. He's almost, you know, it's like, he's his own thing. It's an interesting, his career trajectory, right? Because like, nobody has ever said Keanu Reeves is a great actor. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, I don't think that phrase has ever been uttered, even in his more dramatic stuff, like Drugstore Cowboy or something like that. Nobody's ever come away from those movies and gone, wow, what a phenomenal performance, right? Yeah, but there's something magnetic about the guy, and he's good looking. And more than that, I feel like people know that whatever he's in, he's committed to it. He's 100% on board, whether it's a comedic thing or whatever the case may be, he's all in every movie. And that's really impressive. I think it, just in terms of that alone, the only other person I can think of is Cruise, right? Like 100% commitment to the character and the movie and whatever they're doing and the promotion of the movie and the whole from start to finish, they're in. And when I worked with him briefly, that was absolutely on display. He wanted everything to be perfect. He was friendly to everyone, treated everyone well, treated other people, you know, certain people on the film exceedingly well in terms of like gifting them things and stuff like that, which is also well known. But he's something else. So very excited to see the movie. Just hard to do with a 3.5-year-old.
Especially with a near 3-hour movie.
Yeah, that too. And then also, weirdly, so I've never been a D&D guy, but the Dungeons and Dragons movie, the Rotten Tomato scores are insane.
Yeah, they are. I haven't, because I saw it and I'm like, oh, I remember the other Dungeons and Dragons movie, and that was terrible, the one that came out in the early 2000s.
Yeah, so I never saw that one. But this is like I'm not looking it up right now, but it's like a 94% critic score and a 93% audience score. Like, it's insane.
Well, we saw the trailer when we went to see John Wick 4, and it's like, oh, is this Dungeons and Dragons? And by the end of it, we're like, this looks fun. I won't necessarily rush off to the cinema to watch this one, because I don't get to cinema as often as I'd like. But I will watch that when it drops onto Blu-ray.
Well, that's the thing. It made almost 40 million. They had a sort of over under estimation on what it might make. Paramount's hope was that it was going to make 40 or over, and it made 38 something. So it hasn't quite hit, which means remains to be seen whether those cinema score and Rotten Tomato scores can push it over the top. If they don't, it's kind of a bummer. I mean, like, yes, it's built in IP, but nobody knows what the hell it really is. They just know it's sort of, you know, Chris Pine being funny and Michelle Rodriguez. So I've not seen it yet, but now I want to see it, because I'm amazed that it could have such high scores from critics and audiences alike. I mean, those are like Pixar numbers. You know what I mean? Like nobody gets numbers that good. So
I think the box office number will hold. It might not drop too much because I know a lot of people who are like, oh, look at that. And then they see it on Facebook and they see it on Twitter and people who have watched it have liked it. So they, like yourself, are going, eh, I might go watch that. So I think it'll have legs, as they say.
Yeah. I mean, if everyone says it's fun, like I want to have fun, you know, I want to be a part of that.
Yeah, count me in. Fun things. Give me more of them.
Yeah. So those are two movies that I want to see. And then I think next month, I don't know. Pixar does have a new film that's finally going theatrical again called Elemental, which I think is going to be my almost 4-year-old's first movie in a cinema.
Oh, wow.
It'll be his cinema baptism.
That's got to be really exciting for you as a film fan and as a filmmaker to go, now I'm teaching the next generation to love movies as much as I can.
Yeah. I mean, and I hope he embraces it the way I did when my father showed me movies. You know, like he's already into it. Like we listen to film scores in the car. So like he knows, for example, well, one of the movies he loves is WALL-E, the Pixar film. He's listening to the score to WALL-E so much because he requested it. Dad, do you have WALL-E music? And I'm like, yeah, okay, I'll play WALL-E music. So I put it on. He now knows when he's watching the movie, when, you know, the orchestra will do a hit or something, you know, in a moment. So he'll do it with the movie. He'll go bum bum, you know, and I'm like, my heart is just overflowing. It's like, oh, my kid, you know, look at him go. So yeah, it's something that I am very much looking forward to is slowly doing that. But like, obviously we've gotten into WALL-E. He loves Monsters, Inc. I showed him for the first time last week, Labyrinth.
That could go scary, couldn't it?
You might think that he might not handle that because some of those creatures are definitely frightening. What I did was I skipped over the crazy singing orange flamingo looking things that take your head off.
Yeah.
I skipped that because that used to scare the shit out of me when I was little. I knew that he would not be afraid of like Ludo, the big giant character. I had a feeling that he would be okay with Hoggle and certainly, you know, Sir Didymus, the dog that rides on the other dog.
Yeah.
Be okay. He loves it. He's asked to watch the movie like 6 times in the past week and he watches it from start to finish, minus the head removing characters. He's even picked up on stuff, which is wild to me because I don't think I picked up on things till later that so many of the things that are in the movie are actually in her room before she ever goes into the labyrinth, which, you know, again, I think I started to pick that up over time, but like he's already caught it. He's like, look, there's Sir Didymus, you know, in the beginning. And he's like, oh, look, as the opening credits go. And he also saw she has Where the Wild Things Are book on her table. And he goes, well, I have that book. That's my book.
Wow. So I normally don't notice things like this until I've seen a film like 3-4 times.
Yeah.
So certainly don't notice it the first time.
I mean, granted, he's watched it like, you know, 5 times. He watched it again tonight. So it's embedding itself in him, but he's not afraid of it. He didn't have any bad dreams. He's fully invested. And again, we have our screen, I think in your measurements would be like 3 meters long. So yeah, we have like 150-inch screen. So it's like a movie theater in our house. And he's already watching things really big. And he'll, you know, sometimes in the morning, he'll watch, you know, Peppa Pig on mommy's phone or something as he's having breakfast. But he'll say, Daddy, I want to watch Monsters on the big screen or something like that, you know? So yeah, I think Elemental will be his first in the cinema experience. And I'm really excited for it.
What was yours? What was your first? Can you recall?
The weird thing is, I mean, I would imagine it was like a re-showing of Bambi or something like that.
Yeah.
I think my grandmother took me to Disney stuff when I was very small. I don't remember. I don't think I saw Star Wars in the theater. I would have been 2 when it came out in 77. So I don't, the first one, I don't think I saw in the theater. The Empire, I know I saw in a theater because it scared the shit out of me. So yeah, I for me, I don't know. I always go back to E.T. and Raiders, or rather the inverse of that, Raiders.
Yeah.
And my family took me to a lot of inappropriate movies. I also think it was a different time. You know, it was like I recently was pitching a project. Well, not very recently, but pre-COVID, we were pitching a project to Disney, and we pitched them like a sort of Goonies-esque adventure kind of a thing, and you know, the adventure of Raiders of the Lost Ark, and they were super on board. And when we wrote our treatment, like we wrote stuff because there's a child character and it's like 13 or 14, and we wrote stuff that would be appropriate for that age or what we felt would be appropriate. And they fully, you know, being Disney, were like, wait, you need to skew this younger, blah, blah, blah. And we sort of were like, do you realize that in the Goonies, like the movie opens with the police shooting guns at people in the middle of the street? They lock a child in a freezer with a dead body with a bullet hole in the center of the forehead. They, you know, they take a kid and they put his fingers in a blender. Like they're going to, you know, like all this stuff. There's so much stuff. Raiders of the Lost Ark. Swordsman comes out. What does he do? He shoots the guy, you know, like he doesn't even engage. Like it just feels like the stuff that they're selling to kids now is so much more mild than what we saw.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because my grandmother took me to everything. I mean, you know, when did 48 Hours come out? Like 82,
I think 81, 82. Yeah. And that was a lot of swearing in that film. That is pure Eddie Murphy, that one.
Yeah. I was 7 and I saw that in the cinema. I know I saw that in the cinema. So the weird thing is, you know, when it was a visual thing, they'd cover my eyes. Like the sex scene in Top Gun in 86, I was 11 and they covered my eyes on the sex scene. And it wasn't, you know, nothing really even happened. Yeah. Just a bunch of tongue. With a blue light, but they covered my eyes for that. But other stuff, you know, my father showed me The Godfather at home on VHS, you know, the horse in the bed scene. I mean, like, I saw crazy stuff as a child that I really had no business seeing. But that's also why I thought my son could probably handle Labyrinth. Like I was chancing it, obviously. If he'd have had a bunch of nightmares in the subsequent nights, I'd have been like, well, I screwed up.
Yeah. You're not ready to move on to the never-ending story yet. See Artex dying in a swamp.
Yeah. But he did okay. Yes, Pixar, I'm we're coming out for you. We're coming to the cinema.
Great for Pixar to be back on the big screen as well. Thank you, Bob Iger.
You know, I kind of like, I wish they would go back. I don't think they need to release all the movies they've done, you know, straight to streaming and during the pandemic, but I wish they would put Soul out. It's such a beautiful movie, and like visually, and the music is so great. And like, I would kind of just love to see that like on an IMAX, actually, like put out or put like, you know, do a Pixar day of IMAX. That would be so cool. But yeah, I think my boy is ready. So we're going to open up that experience and see how he takes to it. So Elemental is supposed to come in June, and that will be our first venture.
Nice. Exciting times.
Yeah. Yeah. But my next venture will be John Wick. It seems like it's making a ton of dough. So it seems like it'll hang around for a few more weeks theatrically, and I will definitely go do that. I watched last night, and then we'll probably wrap it up. I watched Creed 3 again.
So did I. I watched Creed 3 for the first time last night. I hadn't seen it before.
That's funny. Yeah. We had family over and they were like, let's watch a movie. And I was like, boy, I've been mostly on TV lately, but I did go to the cinema for that. So I was like, yeah, let's put it on. And man, it's good.
I was always, when it was in the run up to Creed 3, I'm like, I don't want to watch it because there's no Rocky in it. And I watch Creed 1 and Creed 2 because they're Rocky films. And I like Stallone and I like Rocky and I want to see Rocky. What do you mean he's not in the third one? Right, I'm not interested. And then I know a few people that went to see it and they were like, it's really good. I'm like, I'll give it a go. So I was at a loose end last night. So I sat and watched it and it is really good. It still doesn't feel like a Rocky film because Rocky's not in it. So I'm never going to get over that. But as a film, it's great. I thought Jonathan Majors was really good playing a really dislikable character. I'm like, I don't like you, but you are just really good on screen.
So, yeah, it's good.
I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, everything. I mean, the music, the way it's a hell of a debut from Michael B. Jordan as a director. Yeah. He's picked up some stuff.
Hey, Huzz, there's not many sort of first time directors that do that. You're like, this is what I've done. How's this for a first attempt?
And yes, balancing a lot of story and a lot of, you know, backstory, even potentially, I guess, setting up future of the future of the franchise, at least as far as the Creed franchise goes. Yeah, man, just good stuff. Even managed to get a training montage in there, which is okay, man, you're doing it right. Can't be a movie in this franchise without a training montage.
I thought it also felt it had Rocky III vibes to it. And by that, it's that Jonathan Majors' character wasn't a professional boxer. He was a destroyer, just like Clubber Lang was. You know, so you got Rocky I, Rocky II, they're boxers, professional boxers, let's have a fight. Clubber Lang comes into it like, this guy is just crazy angry and he's going to knock your head off in a single swipe. I thought that Jonathan Majors played that type of character as well, which is probably coincidental, but who knows? I don't know if it is.
Yeah, he had a certain menace. And then you hear about his arrest last week and you're like, oh boy, how much of that is real life?
But then you hear about the after, the different stories coming out and you're like, maybe there isn't anything to do with the, it's who knows how this one's going to play out.
The denials. Yeah. I mean, we won't get into the woods on it, but there were several people on Twitter who were like, glad this is finally coming out. He's a psychopath and stuff like that. I was like, wait, really? Oh boy.
Yeah. I've not heard that part come. I mean, that was the initial panic and we all know how social media goes.
Yeah.
The bin fire, isn't it? It's crazy.
Yeah. So, I mean, he and his attorney have shared text messages from the girl who supposedly accused him of whatever. And she's already retracted it to him and apparently to the police. And, you know, in a situation where they have any suspicion of assault, they have to make an arrest. So they did. Who knows? I think that guy is, I mean, again, you know, here we are with the separating the artist from the art, but boy, on screen is he something.
He really is.
And in Creed 3 in particular, and he's got a Searchlight movie coming out in Oscar season, next Oscar season, where he plays a you know, guy who's trying to, his dream is to be a professional weightlifter. And if you think he's big in Creed 3, the shots of him in this movie for Searchlight are like, my God, he makes me feel like a slug.
So in the past couple of weeks, I watched John Wick 4. Makes me feel inadequate because I'm watching Keanu running around, and I now feel massively body inadequate after watching Jonathan Majors. So I need to stop. Yeah. I need to stop watching films. I think I'll just
Majors and Michael B. Jordan. Those shoulders of his, like, good Lord. All right, I'm old
and tired.
Yeah, old and tired. I will just take my seat on the couch. No, I'm trying to get at it. I'm trying to hit the treadmill. I bought a treadmill, so I'm going to get on the damn thing. And I've done it a few times now. And I have a friend who's trying to keep me honest with it. I have to usually find a time to wedge it in before my son goes to sleep because it's kind of loud, which means I won't do it tonight, but I'll knock out some push-ups and some leg ups just to do some kind of movement. And
Get some Rocky soundtracks or Creed soundtracks on the go there. Get some Vince DiCola training montage.
There you go. I will never be Michael B. Jordan, nor will I be Jonathan Majors or Stallone or any of them, but I can try and lose a few pounds at least. That's the goal.
You are Sean O'Banion. Just remember that.
That's it. All right. Well, thank you for listening, everyone. We hope you enjoyed the conversation, and we will catch you in a month's time.